This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. What is the significance of architecture? What is a beautiful building? Writer Alan de Botton takes up these questions in his new book, The Architecture of Happiness. On the program today, we're going to talk about what inspires us and what disappoints us in the buildings and in the places, the spaces in which we live, work, and play. Alan de Botton is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Alan de Botton is the author of several books, fiction and nonfiction, including the novel Kiss and Tell, and the nonfiction books How Proust Can Change Your Life and Status Anxiety, The Architecture of Happiness, his latest book, published by Pantheon. Alan de Botton was born in Zurich. He grew up in Switzerland and in England. He makes his home in London. He joins us this afternoon from New York City. And by the way, you can find him on the web at www.alandebotton.com. And that's ALANDEBOTTON.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Alan, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I found it very interesting to learn that apparently a good number of the world's brightest people have not seen architecture as worthy of serious attention.
Well, I think that there's an awful lot of suspicion, really, against taking architecture and design seriously. The subject can seem self-indulgent. It can seem like people with too much money and time on their hands. It can seem effeminate. It can seem like a distraction from the things that really matter. So throughout history, you've had people in the church, you've had intellectuals, you've had theorists who've sort of cast a stern eye on the whole topic and said, you know, it really doesn't matter what the door handle is like or what the, you know, what the building looks like or what the doors are like. Just get me a simple place to sleep and, you know, that's enough. And then on the other hand, there are people who've thought quite the opposite, that architecture can make a very serious difference to our environment, that it matters intensely what's on the walls and what's on the ceilings. And it's really with that kind of question that I begin my thinking on the subject.
Yeah. The architecture of happiness begins with the description of a house that is home to a family, a terraced house on a tree-lined street. And you write, over the years, its owners have returned from periods away and, on looking around them, remembered who they were.
Yes, I think to some extent, when we say that we feel at home somewhere, really what we mean is that the environment in some way reminds us of who we really are, what we really care about. This doesn't mean to say that our own homes should necessarily be where we feel most at home. There are people who feel most at home, you know, by the edge of the ocean or in a cabin in the hills or even at an airport or a railway station or a library. So I think that term, feeling at home, is a very flexible one, but it reflects something very important. It reflects the idea that in order to feel fully comfortable, we need an environment to support us and to kind of back us up. Traditionally, of course, if you look at the history of religion, churches were intended to be the kind of the home of believers. But you know, even in a secular point of view, that idea carries on. That, you know, we need these, as it were, shrines to ourselves and our commitments and all the things we care about.
Yeah. Well, thinking about this family that you begin the book with and their home, it struck me as that this home for this family is a protective space, and it is like a little bit like our skeletons and our skins and what we put on.
Yes, I mean, definitely, obviously, houses offer shelter, but I think what I was talking about was not so much physical shelter, you know, shelter from the elements, mm-hmm. but also a kind of psychological sanctuary, mm-hmm. Which, you know, which you could get, you know, in only certain kinds of environment. And, you know, a lot of people will say that they've been in houses and in places which objectively have been very sound. They've offered shelter. They've been well cooled and well, but they felt somehow cold or alienated from a psychological point of view. So I think we need a lot from our buildings, not just physical shelter, but also we need a kind of communication. We need our buildings to talk to us about all the things that we think are important in life and that we need to be reminded of on a kind of day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And I think also, though, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, you know, are we comfortable within our own skins? And I think that is important for our buildings.
Yes. I mean, there's very much the assumption that to take an interest in architecture and design means it's all about showing off, particularly showing off money and status. But I think that's to read things too narrowly, because I think some of the things we try and do with our buildings and objects is to show off what we care about, and I think that's quite legitimate. You know, you may want to tell people who come and visit your house that you care about the past, or you're interested in travel, or whatever. So we use houses to communicate ideas of, as it were, what's dearest to us.
Where do you feel most at home?
Where do I feel most at home? Well, it's not always my own home. And there are sometimes times when staying in a hotel, for example, in a hotel room, you can suddenly get back in touch with all sorts of ideas that in the kind of press of a day-to-day life you're cut off from. So I think it wouldn't be paradoxical to say that sometimes I felt very at home precisely when I wasn't in my own house but was kind of on the road.
Has writing this book changed how you look at or how you live in your home, and what is your home like?
I think it's allowed me to think more deeply about how much little things matter when it comes to objects of architecture and design. You know, choosing, there's often an air of triviality around this. You know how couples, when they go out to buy a sofa or glasses or some kitchen taps, they often argue fiercely mm-hmm. about which item to choose, and this has a kind of comedic and ludicrous aspect, as though really what we should be doing is worrying about more important things. But I think what I was able to determine in my book is that actually there's a lot going on in the choice of a kitchen tap. That there are kitchen taps which say one thing, and there are others which say another, and that what we're doing when we choose objects is kind of exercising a really fundamental aspect of our personalities. And so no wonder that there are clashes with other people. And it may be that differences in a view of what a good sofa is a really quite serious indicator of a certain kind of incompatibility.
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with the program here in the States, Designing for the Sexes.
No, I don't know that, but it sounds interesting.
It's a television show where a designer comes in and helps a couple with their various different views of what their home should look like. And on the one hand, we watch it because there is a conflict, but on the other hand, it is very interesting to sort of see the choices that are made and how they want the world to see them and how they want to live in their space.
And I think the important thing to understand is that it's only relatively recently that people have had the money and the choices available to them to kind of decorate their houses in many, many different styles. In my book, I discuss the way that in the 18th century, the dominant style of doing up any house was the classical style. You know, the kind of pedimented temple front, and all over the world, in the United States, Europe, if you had a bit of money, you would build a house in the classical style. And then what starts to happen is the situation we're still in now, which is suddenly there's a lot of choice. Suddenly you can do it in all kinds of styles. And there's a famous house that's often mentioned in histories of architecture and that I discuss, because it's a house where the husband did the front side and the wife did the rear side, and the front is classical and the rear is Gothic, and it was the result of an almighty conflict between the couple. And the reason it appears in architectural histories is that it's a sign of what happened, and I guess what's still happening today, which is people cannot agree on what good taste is.
Oh. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Alan DeBotten. His latest book, The Architecture of Happiness. You can join us this afternoon, listeners, with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Here's something you say in the second essay of the book, What Shall We Build? And that's the title of the essay. And the title of this chapter comes from the title of a book by a 19th century architect. You say this: the creation of beauty, once viewed as the central task of the architect, has quietly evaporated from serious professional discussion and retreated to a confused private imperative.
Yes, there was a way in which In the 20th century particularly, architects became obsessed with an idea of themselves as engineers. And that's why, you know, if you look at the skyline of Manhattan, all those, all the tower blocks that were done, all the skyscrapers done in mid-century, were all subscribed to a very austere kind of technocratic vision. Take the United Nations building or the Seagram building. These were buildings that were apparently just works of pure engineering, very far from the much more decorated style of, say, the Chrysler building, even the Empire State, that believed that architecture was something to celebrate, and that you could be playful and you could decorate buildings. And so all over the modern world, there was a kind of austerity and almost a fear that if you decorated your buildings, you might end up kind of effeminate, trivial. And this has created a world which in many areas is frighteningly bland and very kind of almost macho in its design. There's absolutely none of the things that people like in old buildings, like the floral motifs above the doors or the slightly curved columns or whatever. All those little details that are on older buildings disappeared for a large part of the 20th century because architects started to believe that it wasn't their business to make beautiful buildings. It was their business to create works of engineering. And just as a bridge builder doesn't really worry what the bridge looks like, the bridge builder just gets on with the business of fulfilling its kind of mechanical function. So too, architects thought that they should no longer bother with all those things that architects of the past had cared a lot about, which is kind of how do you dress a building? How do you make a building pretty? That very word "pretty" became very suspicious.
Yeah, it's interesting to see. Well, let me ask you this question: Are we approaching a middle ground now, where we can have both function and beauty?
Yes, I mean, architects aren't quite admitting it, but I mean, if you look at the buildings, someone like Frank Gehry, they're obviously decorated buildings. They're not the reason why those buildings look like that has got nothing to do with function. It's got nothing to do with mechanical function. It's got to do with the fact that Frank Gehry wants to suggest an atmosphere. He wants to communicate things. He wants to, he's looking at architecture as an art again. But he doesn't quite come out and say it, but that's definitely what's going on. So more and more buildings are rediscovering also many of the more feminine touches, I should say, the buildings of the past used to have. You know, you're getting more and more buildings that that do pick up on images like flowers and animals and all of those things that just completely disappeared from modern buildings for a while.
How do modern buildings and old old-fashioned buildings, if I could use that term. How are they coexisting side by side?
I think coexistence is fine. I think the problem comes with pastiche, and it's really pastiche. Pastiche is a problem in all areas of life. I mean, imagine you really love Shakespeare, and you decided that the best thing to do to express your love for Shakespeare was to kind of speak a bit like Shakespeare nowadays. You know, everyone would think you're slightly crazy. And many architects do roughly that equivalent. They, as it were, go for a very literal recreation. And, you know, what you end up with is a kind of Disneyland or Disney World vision of architecture where, you know, I mean, there are large parts of both the United States and the UK which have been made to look as though, I'm thinking of like residential suburbs, they're made to look as though, you know, the crew of the Little House on the Prairie were living there, mm-hmm. when in fact the people who live there are working in extremely, you know, modern jobs and leading extremely modern lives. But there's often a kind of false nostalgia. I understand where that comes from. I mean, it's an interesting question to ask, well, why is it that contemporary American and British taste is so geared towards the natural? You know, if a Martian came to Earth and looked at the way that many of us are living now, they'd think that, you know, we were still a kind of rural agricultural economy where people chopped their own wood and, you know, drove a wagon. But I think the reason for that is that industrialization and modernization has been so fast and so rapid and in many ways so frightening that the last thing that people want when they come home is a kind of further reminder of, you know, the modern way of life. They're looking for something reassuring. I think it's just, I think that's a serious desire, but I think that many architects and house builders kind of abuse that desire and create, you know, really pastiche-like things, you know, panels made out of plastic and, the worst kind of, worst kind of kitsch.
The front porch that's not a front porch.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I live in a very old house, and the folks that we bought it from, they had it decorated in a very modern way. And it was very interesting to see this house. We've changed it quite a bit. But to see that you could put modern furniture and living appliances into a very old house, or that you could make it look like it did when it was built.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I've observed just writing the book and doing other things is that many people who have a very old house will choose modern furniture, mm-hmm. and many people who have a very modern house will choose old furniture.
Yeah.
And I think that what's going on there is fairly healthy. I think a lot of the time what we're doing with architecture is trying to reconcile things, opposites in ourselves, things that are discordant in the outside world. And it's natural that, as it were, we don't want to fall either into an extreme modernity or a kind of extreme nostalgia for history. And so it's normal that people try and mix the two. And really what I think people are doing by mixing things like this is they're saying we want to create, we want to live in a kind of reasonable, judicious balance between past and present. And, you know, that's, I think, a noble approach, both in your own life and also in your architecture.
Yeah. And what does that view mean then also for our concerns about preservation? This is something that's very important to a lot of Americans, it seems to me, at the moment.
Mm. Well, I think what's beginning to emerge is that you can design an environmentally friendly house in almost any style. So, you know, you could have a classically designed house, you could have a very modern one, etc. So the environmental demands don't actually determine the look of a house very much at all. But I think what we're seeing is that some people, want to live in a house that overtly says to the world, I care about the environment. You know, this is a house that takes its responsibilities to the planet seriously. And in a way, that's like a kind of advertisement for the people who live in it. You know, if you go to certain parts of Italy, I'm thinking of Tuscany or Siena or Florence, and you look at some of the old merchant houses, they often have a crest, a kind of coat of arms on the front of the door. And that coat of arms tells you a little bit about the family that used to live in the house. It was a way of signaling to people, you know, here's here's, you know, lives X person, and this is sort of the kind of thing they care about. And I think, you know, we can do this in a modern way with our architecture. So if you care about the environment, you can build a house that will communicate that to the outside world.
Mm. There's a number of fascinating photographs in the book of houses and buildings. And I want to talk with you a little bit about the house you mentioned, Italy, in the stone house in Liguria.
Yes, well, that's a house that I was particularly keen on. I came across a house that I think a really acute issue for many people nowadays is how do you reconcile the past and the present? You know, how do we juggle with lives where everything's moving so fast and everything's so exciting in a way in the present, but at the same time we want to hang on to the past? And I came across a picture of a house that seemed almost like a model of how we might live today. Because it's a house in the Italian Alps that's built in the most traditional way, very old kind of dry stone wall building techniques. And yet that's balanced up with a very kind of geometric concrete form and frame to the house. And it's almost like, you know, if a house were a person, that person would be a kind of very well-adjusted citizen of the modern world who both, you know, was excited about the present, but very much in tune with the past as well. And that's a very difficult juggling act. And I think if you look at many buildings that work well, there's real similarities between, as it were, a healthy, well-balanced building and a healthy, well-balanced person. And when we condemn buildings, we often condemn buildings using much the same language as we would condemn people. You know, we say a building looks arrogant, or it looks heavy, or it looks secretive. So, as I say, a real connection between a good person and a good house.
Yeah. What is it like to live inside the stone house in Liguria, I wonder?
I'd like to be able to say that one's happy all the time, but at the same time, I don't believe that architecture can, you know, that beautiful surroundings can necessarily always do everything for us. And actually, I begin my book with a very chilling picture somewhere near the beginning of the book, mm-hmm. where I found a photo of Hermann Göring, one of the leading Nazis who lived in one of an extremely beautiful house, stuffed full of the great treasures of Europe that he'd ransacked. And it was genuinely a very lovely house. But it didn't do anything for Göring, in the sense it didn't inspire him to be good and to, as it were, become like his building. Because his building's full of pictures, you know, preaching modesty and kindness and all of these things. And I think this is always a problem for people who take architecture seriously. How much does it influence us? And I think you have to admit that architecture is not like an aspirin which you can take and it just will change your mind. It's not like a law. It doesn't force you to behave a certain way. It just suggests that you behave a certain way. And sometimes, you know, people are not ready to listen. So it's a kind of troubling feature if you respect architecture.
Yeah. Speaking of ready to listen, you tell a story about Paul Tillich and his encounter with a painting by Sandro Botticelli in Berlin during the First World War. What would you like to say about that painting and his experience of it?
Well, it's a fascinating story in which Paul Tillich, a German theologian, recounts how, as a young man, he never really had any interest in beautiful things. He just thought they were a bit ridiculous. And then he went to fight in the First World War, and he came back during his leave, and he came across this picture by Botticelli, which hangs in a museum in Berlin. And he writes very movingly about the way that he looked at this picture and just started crying. And the reason he started crying was that the picture seemed to be the opposite of what life was like all around him. All around him, people were in the most ghastly war. There were terrible, you know, acts of savagery. And, you know, but yet this Botticelli just seemed to show a kind of tenderness and sweetness, everything that his life was not. And I use that point really to say that very often, you know, we'll start taking an interest in the small details of everyday life, be it, you know, gardening or the beauty of sunlight falling on a wall or of a picture hanging on a wall or something. These things often touch us when as it were, we've been acquainted with the opposite. You know, it's after you've come round from a very serious operation and you see the sunlight, you know, just lighting up the windowsill, that can create such a moment of joy. Or, you know, if you've come through a very difficult time, you know, and you'll suddenly see a daffodil growing in a pot, and, you know, it can be very, very moving. And so I think we're wrong to say that it's only people with perfect lives who are interested in architecture and design. You know, the idea we often get from magazines, that architecture magazines and design magazines, that somehow architecture and design are the preserve of kind of, almost superhuman people who lead these perfect airbrushed lives. I think it's precisely all of us when life is particularly difficult that we're likely to be struck by these kind of very small moments of intense pleasure that that architecture can deliver.
Yeah, it strikes me in this painting, while there is closeness and tenderness of Madonna and Child and angels and lilies, There is a bit of sadness in the Madonna's face.
Yes, yes, it is. It's a slightly sad picture, but not that we necessarily are become sad by looking at it. And I think that's the interesting thing about many works of art that are a bit sad. They don't make us sad. In fact, they allow us to feel safely sad with them. And I think one of the great problems of daily life is that we're forced to be so cheerful all the time. and one of the great things about art, you know, you read a novel or a film, whatever, is that suddenly we're able to kind of release our emotions and our disappointment. And that's why we sometimes cry at just how difficult life is. Our not just difficult for the characters in the novel or in the film, but as it were, we're also crying for ourselves.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Alan de Botton. His latest book, The Architecture of Happiness. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, 333. WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I don't profess to be a connoisseur of architecture in terms of what's good and what's bad. I just get a sensory perception of looking at a building or house and say, well, that looks good to me. And one thing that I've noticed here in Champaign-Urbana, especially with the new buildings, is that they look good to me. I could think of the M1 building in downtown Champaign and some of the buildings on the U of I campus, until I look up at the top of the building and they're exposed in an unsightly way to me are the heating and air conditioning units. And I wonder, why didn't the architect figure out a way to conceal that? Because to me it detracts from the beauty of the building. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that it's got to do with the way that architects are very attached to the idea of honesty. And so they think, if there's an air conditioning unit up there on the roof, I've got to show it to you. If there's an elevator shaft, I've got to show it to you. And I think that's kind of crazy, and it doesn't really make sense. I mean, it's like a painter saying, I had a really hard time finishing this canvas, so I'm not going to finish it, or I'm going to show you the lunch that I had while finishing the canvas, etc. I mean, I think it seems crazy to push the word honesty in this area, and yet very many architects are very keen on this. And so, you know, the older idea of architects was that you need to dress a building, like you need to dress a person.
Right.
You need to hide the bits that are not necessarily that attractive. And that the best, you know, the best buildings are the best dressed buildings. It's perplexing that architects have not realized this necessarily or not remembered it. I'm hopeful that slowly they will.
But you think that's the trend now in architecture, is to be honest by leaving such fixtures exposed for the world to see?
I mean, to be fair, there are sometimes examples of buildings where the fixtures have a certain kind of beauty, just in the way, you know, if you go to an airport and you look at some of the oil cylinders or even just the aircraft itself with its jet engines and its wingtips, these can be beautiful pieces of technology. So I'm not saying all technology looks ugly, and there are even, you know, elevator shafts and air conditioning units that can be beautiful. But that's normally only because a designer has paid particular attention to them. If you buy just a standard air conditioning unit, it doesn't look very attractive.
That's my impression. It just the building is looking good to me, and then all of a sudden I look at the up at the roof, and you know there is something that unsightly and detracts from the overall beauty of the building.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. 333-9455 800-222-9455. Why do we have? You know, I would agree with the caller in that we have some beautiful buildings in our community, but we also have some buildings that seem to go up within the blink of an eye and are really horrific.
Mm. I think that many people experience architecture as something that happens to them. They don't understand who's doing it, how it all works. You know, just one day it appears. And that's because basically in the United States and right across many parts of the developed world, we've abandoned architecture to the private market, private businesses, who more or less do what they want within certain kind of codes, adhering to fire codes, etc. And I mean, I'm a real free marketeer when it comes to many areas of life, but when it comes to architecture, I think that architecture goes way beyond simply the person who's building it and is going to profit from it and the users who are going to use it. Because architecture, a building affects everybody. Even if you don't work in a building or live in it, it's going to be there on the skyline. So it's a community matter. And yet so often the community is not consulted, doesn't get involved, doesn't understand, is truly sort of powerless. There are examples from around the world of things going slightly better. I was talking to someone about life in the Netherlands, where what they do there is that they force property developers to use good architects. So they'll have like a team of rotating team of quality architects on any project, and that has brought up the standard of architecture very, very to a very, very high level. But it's a rare case, and mostly the free market does reign and produces some, you know, some very substandard things that all of us then have to live with.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener on line one, good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm from Urbana.
Okay.
Some feedback on your guest's earlier comment. I remember hearing other architects and critics of architectures discussing the modern-day skyscrapers, and I recall some saying that they were influenced by the architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, and the fact that they were so popular comes from the fact that they're cheap to put up.
Mm.
And for homes and the architecture of homes, or lack of it, in this area, well, a lot of houses are built as speculation houses by contractors, and folks seem to just tolerate what's available, whether or not it's harmonious or energy efficient or makes effective use of light or protects us from some sunlight.
I think a lot of this has got to do, you know, with education. I mean, 20 years ago, none of us thought too much about how much fat was in our diet or how much salt there was. And then gradually, you know, more and more people started pressuring us to notice these things or take this, you know, similar pressures with the environment. We're now aware of how much damage can get done through driving or flying or whatever. So there are lots of examples of people being educated to notice things. And when it comes to architecture, most of us have no education in this field. You know, at high school, you know, you get taught a little bit about literature and something about art, but very rarely do you get taught architecture. And yet, for most people, architecture is the art form that they're going to have, as it were, in front of their eyes most of the time. And yet, most people are very unconfident about saying what they like. And, you know, it's a very, basically, the house builders have got a really uncritical audience to deal with.
Amen.
I mean, it's like a situation with a restaurant where the customer just doesn't notice whether, you know, the salad is fresh and the meat is well cooked or not. And so naturally, you know, the restaurant would drop its standards because they're not being pushed enough by their customers. And the same has happened in architecture, that as where the demand for things isn't high. So people don't go, look, you've just built a house with a fake columns and a plastic portico and, there's no symmetry in the building, et cetera, et cetera. You know, people just go, oh, it's a fairly nice house, and they'll just buy it. So we're not sensitized enough.
Amen again.
Yeah.
The caller wanted a follow-up? Nope. Okay, very good. I thought it was fascinating. You tell a story in the book about John Ruskin making a study of the buildings of Venice, coming to the realization that few Venetians seemed to take note of the beauty of their city. So that's something interesting to take note of as well.
I mean, I think that whenever people are trying to persuade city planners or municipal authorities to pay for some big civic project to make somewhere more beautiful, that they often try and make the claim that if you make a place more beautiful, then people will be happier and good things will happen. I want to believe that, and I do believe that, but I also recognize that that's not always true. And you point out in my book, I do mention the work of John Ruskin, where he goes to Venice and he looks around him and he's forced to acknowledge that the people living in the most beautiful city on earth, but they still have arguments with their wives and their husbands, the kids squabble and they're sometimes dissatisfied, etc. But I think we should only push that argument so far. You could almost compare the importance of architecture to the importance of the weather. Now, some people could say, well, look, the weather, I can be happy in any weather. But at the same time, we realize that if the weather is good, it draws to the surface all our more optimistic thoughts. It makes us readier to be happy. And obviously, sometimes we can't be. We can't do justice to a fine spring day. The problems that beset us are too large. And sometimes our joy is so large that even on a rainy November night, it doesn't really matter. We're in heaven. So architecture, nevertheless, is one of these things that can have some influence on us, about as much influence as beautiful weather. And that's not nothing. I think that's still a very important contributing factor to our state of mind.
Let's take another call. A listener in Farina, line 4. Hi.
Hi, I like your approach. And I think it's a great comment that the elitist kind of thing about, the normal people can't, truly appreciate architecture. It's got to be some elitist person. The building, two buildings I see that make me happy. The Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco. Every time I see that, I'm from that Bay Area. Every time I was near it or saw it, it just makes me happy to look at it. And also, there's no air conditioning on the roof because the roof is a point. Can you comment on that? And also, about 100 years ago, there were houses built called octagon houses, and then those are kind of cool. But I like the geodesic kind of dome houses, the Buckminster Fuller idea. And could you comment on those types of houses also?
Yeah,
it makes me happy also.
I think I was taken by your distinction between kind of the ordinary public and the architectural expert, and there's been such a divide between, as it were, what expert taste likes and what ordinary people like. This has been a phenomenon right across the arts in the 20th century. There's like the highbrow novel and the lowbrow novel. There's highbrow music and lowbrow music. Instinctively, I'm suspicious of that, and I think that a good work of art should, as it were, manage to satisfy all quarters. And if you're only satisfying the lowbrow or the highbrow, you've probably got a problem on your hands. There are buildings that we're constantly told are very beautiful, but no one really likes them. And similarly, there are other buildings that have, people find great affection for them, even though, they're not experts. And I think, as I'm in New York now, I can comment on some buildings here. And if you take something like the Chrysler Building, that is a building that just pleases everybody, experts and non-experts. There's just something about it. It's graceful. It's clean. It's elegant. It's feminine, if you like. It's very far from modern buildings by, say, architects like Zaha Hadid that look like a piece of crumpled paper that someone's about to throw in the waste paper bin, that most people think, maybe I'm stupid, but I don't get this. And I think there's something wrong if if that's the views of most people, you've probably got a problem on your hands as an architect.
Yeah, one of the most exhilarating moments I've had in my life when it comes to architecture is being on a plane years ago, small plane, and approaching LaGuardia, and flying around Manhattan. It was breathtaking. Flying around the Chrysler Building. It was unbelievable.
Sure. But, you know, if we think of the buildings that are most loved in Manhattan, they tend to be the buildings built before the Second World War or shortly after, i.e. they tend to be buildings which are decorated, you know, which have Gothic touches, which have got Art Deco touches, etc. That's what people love. And then what happened is that towers, I mean, it would be very hard to find anyone who would really fall in love with some of the things that were built in the 60s and 70s in New York, some of the most very kind of bland skyscrapers, just concrete and glass extending right up to the sky. You know, most of us feel that's boring, and I think that architecture has to be playful. Architecture has to remember that it should delight us, it should please us, it shouldn't just frighten us or intimidate us with its severity.
Mm. I would like to talk, before we run out of time, a little bit about New Orleans. Cities, communities that have seen destruction due to some cataclysmic event, earthquake, fire, storm. When it comes to rebuilding, what have been stories of success?
Well, on the whole, the stories have not been good, because I think that good architecture, on the whole, emerges through time and through the actions of many, many people. It's when you've got a kind of master planner, it's when you've got one big scheme, that you tend to have a disaster on your hands, because very often it's not, you know, one person can't determine how millions of people should best live their lives. And, you know, the worry with somewhere like New Orleans is that it's going to be, it's going to end up as a kind of grand civic vision that's going to forget what ordinary people want from their communities and their neighborhoods. And after all, what made New Orleans special, where in the parts where it worked, was that it was had grown up very slowly. Obviously, one of the oldest settlements, and it had been changed very incrementally over decades, hundreds of years, through the accumulated knowledge of residents about what they wanted, etc. And it's going to be very hard to produce that instantly. So I think patience, above all, is important. And, you know, trying to remember that it's very often ordinary people in ordinary neighborhoods that know much better than some master planner, you know, dropped into the situation, what's going to work.
Oh. The last essay, in your book is The Promise of a Field. Here I'd like your thoughts on all the driving so many people do to get from work to home and from home to work. I read in a New Yorker article very recently, roughly one out of every six American workers commutes more than 45 minutes each way.
Mm. Yes, and I mean, I think the reason for that, obviously, is some very bizarre ideas which reigned in the 20th century about how neighborhoods should be arranged, which is that you have the bedroom in one area and the office in another, down a highway. Slowly, people are remembering that what made cities like San Francisco or New York work very well and be very satisfying is that all these different functions, sleeping, socializing, working, can actually be jumbled together quite successfully. It's more complicated to do, it's more complicated to build, can be more expensive to build, but the results are generally much more satisfying. And in the end, property prices are higher too, because people don't necessarily like to be spread out. And this is, you know, all over the modern world. We're discovering that if you, you know, people commute to work not because they're evil or they hate the environment or anything like that. They do that because that's just the way that city planners have laid things out. It doesn't have to be that way. You know, people don't commute that much in Manhattan. People don't commute that much in Paris or in Amsterdam. These are phenomenon of the great car cities of the modern world, and there's a serious problem with them. And I think, you know, when we talk about tackling the environment, really one of the first things that we're going to have to tackle is the layout of roads and architecture. That's really at the heart of the whole problem. It's not just not turning on your tap too much and saving electricity. It's to do with how buildings and streets are laid out. That's the number one cause of waste.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Alan, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Alan de Botton, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author, most recently, of The Architecture of Happiness. The book is published by Pantheon.